For decades, there has been no federal support for gun violence research.
I was told by senior researchers in no uncertain terms to not pursue a career in firearm injury prevention.
But that's all starting to change. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway for February 13th. Also on the show, journalist Carlos Maza takes on misinformation on YouTube.
It's not some like very heroic thing. I'm just deeply concerned about the future of political discourse in a democracy.
Plus, it's Valentine's Day Eve, and though big-name card companies are going bankrupt, you're still sending cards and, according to this caller, even making them yourselves.
I make all my own cards. I'm an artist, and I do special drawings, write personal notes, and decorate the envelopes as well. The envelopes are especially fun. I incorporate the name and address into elaborate pictures.
877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. All that and more. Let's get to it. Tomorrow marks 2 years since a gunman shot and killed 17 people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida.
In a little over 6 minutes, 17 of our friends were taken from us, 15 were injured, and everyone, absolutely everyone, in the Douglas community was forever altered. Everyone who was there understands. Everyone who has been touched by the cold grip of gun violence understands.
The Parkland shooting led to a wave of activism by young people around the country, demanding that lawmakers enact substantive gun control legislation.
We're going to take this to every election, to every state and every city. We're going to make sure the best people get in our elections to run, not as politicians, but as Americans. Because this is not cutting it.
And while the sweeping overhauls that activists push for are still far from a reality, there has been one significant development from the federal government. In December, Congress approved $25 million for gun violence research to be split equally between the CDC and the National Institutes of Health. It was the first time in over 20 years that federal funding had been approved for this type of research. That's because back in 1996, the Dickey Amendment was passed, prohibiting the CDC from using federal funds for research that, quote, advocated for gun control. Out of fear of losing more funding, the CDC essentially stopped doing research into gun violence. The National Institute of Health soon followed. Despite limited research, the CDC estimates that 40,000 people each year are killed from firearm-related deaths. According to a recent study from the University of Michigan School of Medicine, firearm injuries were the second leading cause of death for U.S. children and adolescents from 2008 to 2017. And yet again, barely any research into gun violence has been conducted since the Dickey Amendment was passed. Now Congress is finally giving the CDC and the NIH funding to make necessary research possible again. And that's where we start today on The Takeaway. Joining us now to talk about the future of gun violence research is Dr. Megan Ranney, an emergency physician at Brown University and chief research officer for Affirm Research, and Mark Rosenberg, who was the first director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you for having
us on. It's a pleasure.
Mark, can you tell me about the gun violence research you conducted at the CDC before the Dickey Amendment was passed in 1996?
Sure. And let me tell you why we thought research was important. And it's that we are basically in a standoff where people think that either you can prevent gun violence or you can protect gun rights. This was a strategy proposed by the NRA. They said these two are at odds, but there are actually ways that you can both reduce gun violence and protect gun rights. How do you find them? You look for those ways. You look through research because you need research to see what ideas will work. And the research basically answers four simple questions. The first question is, what's the problem? Who gets killed? Who gets shot? Where? Why? How? When? Does it happen? Under what circumstances? And are these increasing or decreasing? But that's what's the problem. The second question is, what are the causes? What's the role of mental illness? What's the role of drugs or alcohol? The third question is, what works to prevent it? And you need to find things that work both to prevent gun violence and to protect gun rights. But through research, you can find what works and what achieves both of those goals. And the fourth question is, how do you do it? How do you take the things you find through research and translate them into policy?
Yeah, and one of your studies, a landmark study really, showed having a gun in the home was more dangerous than not having one. Can you talk to me about how that study helped stop funding for the CDC?
The NRA had been saying, and still says, that if you care about your family and you want to keep your family safe, you'll have a gun in your home. So we looked at the question, does having a gun in your home really make you safer? And what we found showed that not only does having a gun in your home not make you safer, but it increases the risk tremendously that someone in your home will be murdered with a gun, or that someone in your home will commit suicide with a gun. The NRA didn't like these findings because they thought it would be bad for business. So the NRA set about a campaign to stop the research. And they got Jay Dickey, a congressman from rural Arkansas, to head up their attack against us. And they tried to put CDC's Injury Center out of business and to stop the research that we were doing.
And Dr. Ranney, what has it been like for you as a researcher wanting to study gun violence in the aftermath of the Dickey Amendment?
So I started my career soon after the Dickey Amendment, and I was told by senior researchers in no uncertain terms to not pursue a career in firearm injury prevention, and that it was a pointless thing to study because there would never be funding for it. Many of us listened for a while, and largely because of the Dickey Amendment, many of the folks that had been doing research in the field stopped doing it. So there were only a few intrepid folks across the country who continued to do this work. As a result, it was really tough for me to find mentors. And just like in business, in research, you need people to help kind of show you the ropes and teach you how to be a better researcher. But over time, with persistence, I found some people, including folks at the University of Michigan, who you quoted, and at UC Davis. And for many of us, kind of the mid-2000s, and then leading into Sandy Hook, we started to say it's not okay to be silent, and we won't let the Dickey Amendment silence us, because in reality, it didn't ever ban research. It just created fear.
And Dr. Ranney, do you think the activism that followed the Parkland shooting helped renew the push for this kind of research?
I think it was the activism following the Parkland shooting. It really, though, started after Sandy Hook. It was after the tragedies in Aurora and Sandy Hook that we started to see many of us writing op-eds, both in medical journals and in popular press, talking about the importance of research and the importance of that public health approach that Dr. Rosenberg outlined, that four-step approach, and talking about the ways in which this can be done in conjunction with, or even with leadership from, the gun-owning community. In fact, that's why we founded Affirm Research, was to make sure that we have voices from all groups and all sides who are represented in the research.
And Mark, do you see that with all these tragedies, these mass shootings, that there are people who are in support of gun rights are becoming, I guess, more open to this kind of research?
I think key people, legislators, some Republicans, some people from red states, are starting to understand the value of research. And Jay Dickey himself, though he started out, we started out as arch enemies, people who hated each other for what we were doing. Jay Dickey came around to see that we needed to restart the research. And in fact, he came out and said, we need to get it started. And one of the points Jay Dickey wanted to make was that if Jay and I started out as mortal enemies, and we could come not only to agree on the importance of science and the importance of research, not only to agree, but actually to become friends and people who trusted about each other and cared about each other, if we could do it, then anyone could do it. And so I think this last year, when Congress approved an appropriations to restart the research, and I can't overemphasize how important that is, that's a huge step, a really important step to solving the problem. That was done with Republican and Democratic support in the House. And the Dickey Amendment, as Megan said, and she really is courageous, and I need to emphasize how brave she was to go into this field. But last year, when the House approved this, they did it with bilateral support. They started by saying in the past that they needed to get rid of the Dickey Amendment because it was seen as a threat and an obstacle. But what happened last year is Jay Dickey's former wife helped write in testimony that said, now the Dickey Amendment can actually be a bridge to getting the support of people all over the spectrum for research. Because what the Dickey Amendment does is it says you can't use this money that Congress appropriates for research. You can't use it to lobby for gun control. You can do the research, but you can't use it to lobby for gun control. So this gave cover to some Republicans on the Appropriations Subcommittee to vote for this. And this is something that will need to be expanded. The research will need to be done well. It will need to be scientifically objective. And it will need to find things that do both reduce gun violence and protect gun rights.
Dr. Ranney, is it clear how the CDC and the NIH could use this new funding and the kind of benefits we might see from this research?
Yes, absolutely. The CDC has already moved quickly to release a funding announcement to train young scholars in the field and has another one projected to be released within a month to fund large grants on firearm injury prevention. And I imagine that NIH will soon follow suit. I think that a lot of what we're going to see early on is a focus on firearm suicide prevention. Two-thirds of gun deaths in this country are suicides. And a focus on identifying risk factors and how to mitigate them. This is going to be done in conjunction with the healthcare community, but also in conjunction with trusted messengers in communities across the country. You know, this field has had so little research done for the past 23 years that it's almost wide open. It would be like if we'd done no research on heart attacks since 1996. There's so much that we need to know. And I'll mention here that although the $25 million is amazing and is a great step in the right direction, what we really need is over $1 billion a year in order for firearm injury prevention to be funded the same way as other diseases that kill the same number of people each year. So we have a long ways to go and lots of questions to answer.
Dr. Ranney, is this changing the morale of people in your field?
It is. You know, already in the last year or two, we've seen a dramatic growth in the number of people who are dedicating time and resources really for free to researching this really important area. And I think we're going to see an explosion of folks, brilliant minds who are dedicated to taking this on and finding solutions that work for every community across America. I'm just thrilled and excited for what comes next.
Dr. Ranney, are you worried that this funding could be cut under this administration?
Absolutely. That is always a concern, particularly in this area of research. The president's proposed budget for the coming year that was released just a couple days ago does not include a line item for firearm injury prevention funding. I think it's on all of us to continue to be vocal about the importance of this work and about the need for it and about the fact that it really is a bipartisan effort. This is not about gun control versus gun rights. This is about creating prevention strategies that work for our communities, the same way that we have reduced the number of car crash deaths without taking automobiles off the road. We can effectively reduce gun deaths in this country while also very much respecting Americans' rights to own firearms.
Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency physician at Brown University and chief research officer for Affirm Research. And Mark Rosenberg is the former director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Arun.
Thank you, Arun.
As federal and state legislation around gun safety continues to stall, some parents are taking matters into their own hands by going through their local school boards to get parents to commit to locking up their guns. According to the Violence Project's mass shooter database, more than 90% of school shooters are students at the schools in which they open fire. 80% of school shooters accessed firearms through their family. Last June, the Los Angeles School Board unanimously supported a resolution that asks parents to safely store guns. Donna Finkelstein, whose daughter was shot and wounded in a school shooting, spearheaded this movement.
It's very hard to pass legislation, especially around guns and gun violence. So to me, it's all about prevention, and it always has been. That's the best impact I could make and we could make as a community.
School districts around the country have followed suit with similar efforts, but many have been largely overlooked in the national debate about gun control. Jillian Peterson is a professor of criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she joins me to talk about this. Hi, Jillian.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Can you describe these new preventative measures that parents are taking and exactly how they work?
I think parents are saying, you know, we're tired of waiting for Congress to do something. We know that perpetrators are students of the school. We know their kids in crisis, and we know that they're getting their guns from family members. So if we want to prevent this from happening, one thing we can do is make it harder to get those guns from family members. That's a matter of almost doing kind of a public health campaign to explain to parents the importance of safe storage, explain how to do it, resources to get it done, and then in some cases, the consequences of not doing it.
And how widespread are these efforts?
You know, I've just really started hearing about this. I think it's a relatively new approach. And part of that is I think we're just now getting this data out that says perpetrators of school shootings are using their family's weapons. So I think this is a relatively new effort, and it's kind of popping up in these little communities that are really pushing for it on the local level.
I'm curious, what are your own questions as you look at this sort of grassroots effort? Do you think that it would be more than just symbolic and actually be able to change the way in which families and parents store their guns?
You know, I hope that it would. We don't have a ton of data yet to know how well this works. It depends on kind of who you ask, but around 50% or a third of gun owners are not storing their guns safely. And part of that could just be a lack of education. Part of that could be a lack of resources. And so if we can provide that as a community, say, no one's saying don't have guns, we're just saying store them safely to protect kids, that might really have an impact.
It is amazing when you look at the different places around the country where this is being passed, or at least is being debated. Phoenix Union High School District just enacted a policy similar to what there is in Los Angeles. St. Louis Public Schools is going to vote on a similar proposal on Tuesday. Five school districts in Southern California, Denver Public Schools. It sounds like there is something really that is going on across the country that sort of speaks to the heart of how people are taking this upon themselves.
Yeah. And I think this is something that we can do. It's something easy. It's actionable. It's local. It doesn't take any act of Congress. And it would be really effective. And I think we're seeing kind of a shift in how we think about school safety, what we've been doing and what we can be doing, and thinking, let's be really more preventative and let's take it into our own hands. And this is a pretty nonpartisan issue. Most people agree on it, so it feels very doable.
Why is this nonpartisan? Is this something that you think does actually get buy-in from both sides?
I do think it gets buy-in from both sides. You know, as soon as you mention the word guns, people tend to dig in their heels. But talking about safe storage, I think, is something that most people agree with. When we look at kind of public surveys, vast majority of people, gun owners included, agree that safe storage is important.
I mean, in the past, a large focus has been on lobbying Congress for change, but that hasn't been especially successful. Why do you think these efforts aren't meeting as much resistance?
I think because they're so local. I think because it's parents of a school and it's a community coming together and saying, what can we do to make sure this doesn't happen here? And here's something we can do. We can educate, we can provide resources, we can kind of take care of the people in our community and say, what can we actually do right here? So it feels sort of more connected than what's happening in Washington.
There has been a previous debate about, preventing more of these tragedies by, I guess, taking very aggressive measures, arming people and the like. Has that been met with a lot of support, or is that sort of dissipating?
For the last, say, 20 years post-Columbine, we've been doing this approach that's really aggressive, and it's about assuming that this is going to happen and there's nothing we can do about it. How do we minimize casualties? So it's active shooter drills, and it's facial recognition software, and it's arming teachers. Those policies, I think we can say, have not worked. School shootings are getting more frequent. They're getting deadlier. And so I think there is this paradigm shift happening now that we have more data to say, okay, these are kids in our community. They are in crisis. They're suicidal. They're getting guns from family members. How can we use that data to actually prevent this from happening rather than training people how to run, hide, and fight and shoot perpetrators when it does?
Finkelstein, who we heard from at the beginning of the segment, says like you, that this is a nonpartisan prevention strategy. That being said, has there been any pushback to what these parents are trying to do?
You know, not that I've heard. I'm sure that there's always people that would read that letter and say that they want their guns loaded and near them. I haven't heard of any kind of organized pushback or even pushback individually on the local level.
Earlier this week, the two largest teachers' unions said they wanted schools to revise or get rid of active shooter drills. Why is that?
You know, more and more research is coming out to show that these drills can cause trauma to students, that they increase fear, and that they increase anxiety. And as that research builds, at the same time, we have no research to show that these are effective at reducing casualties. And I think that fact that we talked about, that over 90% of perpetrators are students of the school, gives you pause when you think about, okay, the perpetrators themselves then would be running through all of these drills and would know the school's exact response, which can actually be used to increase casualties instead of decrease them. So I think it's A, it doesn't make sense from a security standpoint, and B, we know that these drills are traumatizing our kids.
Jillian Peterson is a professor of criminal justice at Hamline University. Jillian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Journalist Carlos Maza has had a complicated relationship with YouTube.
Last year, I went through a huge spat with YouTube very publicly and drew the ire of a bunch of really prominent right-wing YouTubers, and that triggered a bunch of death threats against me and my family, but also against my employer.
His employer at the time was Vox, where he was a video producer and media critic for the series Strike Through. Carlos, who politically identifies as a socialist, was targeted for a long time by a conservative YouTuber named Steven Crowder. Crowder made videos mocking Maza for being gay and Cuban American. Last year, Carlos called out YouTube for its handling of hate speech, opening a national conversation about the platform's policies. Now Carlos is starting a new and surprising chapter of his story. He recently left Vox and decided to run straight into the belly of the beast. He'll be bringing media criticism to YouTube as a full-time content creator there. And he says he'll work from the inside to combat the misinformation and hate that runs rampant in corners of the YouTube world.
It's not some, like, very heroic thing. I'm just deeply concerned about the future of political discourse in a democracy. And I think up until this point, the growth of the far fringe right on YouTube has been a problem that's not been taken seriously enough, both by independent progressive actors and by news media more broadly.
I sat down with Carlos to talk about what he hopes to accomplish with the move. And I asked him to start by painting us a picture of the kind of person and message he's trying to counter with his YouTube presence.
There's this genre of right-wing YouTuber that is defined largely by, like, a hostility towards what they see as political correctness, hostility towards multiculturalism, hostility towards leftist kind of identity politics. And then there's a fear, suspicion of immigrants. There's a fear, suspicion of feminism, the types of things that you'd expect in a corporate HR meeting. There's lots of hostility towards that. And then in terms of, like, style, I'd say the things that unite them is, like, kind of like an authoritarian speech mode. So, like, no sense of vulnerability or weakness, no uncertainty in their speech, condescension or hostility towards other ideas, and a kind of rapidity of speech. There's, like, a kind of speed and brutality with which they speak that's, like, I think is meant to, like, engender this idea of, like, a tough guy or a strong man. It's like a very persuasive kind of avalanche of certainty that marks not just right-wing speakers, but all kinds of speakers on YouTube. The platform itself is kind of like an authoritarian platform because it rewards those who speak with confidence directly to an audience with no conversation, and so kind of lends itself to demagogues.
It actually, the algorithm specifically rewards those attributes?
It's not the algorithm. It is the nature of the platform that it was designed to be a place that privileges authenticity, quote-unquote. This idea that what you're getting on YouTube is this authentic, direct speaker-to-audience interaction, which is unlike a CNN, which you kind of recognize immediately that it's filtered through a whole bunch of lenses and has
this side versus that side.
Right.
Balance.
And also, I'm a journalist. I'm separate from the conversation. Yeah. Here's a reporter who's talking to someone else on the field. YouTube, you're you, the individual, are being spoken to, which is a naturally kind of like an authoritarian relationship. I'm telling you what to think. I'm telling you what's going on. I am showing you the evidence. You do not talk back to me. There's no one else here. I'm not answering to anybody else. That lends itself very well to demagogues, both on the left and the right.
So you're stepping into YouTube. You just launched sort of like this curtain raiser kind of video and introduction. Who do you imagine your audience will be?
The biggest difference is they're much younger than people who would be like on a cable news or who might be subscribing to the New York Times. So a younger audience, politically curious, but not watching TV. So not obsessed with the TikTok of what's happening in the news cycle in the way sort of an avid Fox News or CNN viewer might be interested in. I would think they are politically progressive, though, in the same way that I think a lot of teenagers are, in that they have a kind of empathy for others and a curiosity about the world and an anxiety about the climate, maybe, but are not, you know, they're not reading Chomsky. They're not like Marxist. They're not baked into theory, which I think sort of weirdly enough is very similar to the audience that the alt-right is aiming for on YouTube. People who are politically curious, but not that interested, people who are not reading a bunch of political theory, who are relatively young and are kind of open to persuasion. The alt-right is just very good at capturing that group, especially younger men and younger white men. And there is still, despite people's best efforts, a sort of a gap on the left there. So there are a lot of, you know, leftist literary critics, but not a lot of like explicit leftist political content creators on YouTube still.
What do you think is sort of responsible for that void?
I think the rise of the YouTube right is a byproduct of the failure of the right, for the most part, to penetrate into mainstream media. So like The Blaze and The Daily Wire and Breitbart have invested a good amount of resources in developing YouTube shows because they recognize that it's got a kind of a low barrier to entry and this incredibly powerful technology to reach a bunch of new converts. But for the most part, if you are a progressive journalist or commentator, you have all these places that can catch you career-wise, whether it's leftist mainstream publications or you can just go work for MSNBC as a commentator. So you're kind of siloed to the world of like corporate, sort of mainstream, milquetoast, a largely neutered commentary. Mm-hmm. You don't really have a reason to flourish on YouTube. The right has been forced to go there. So Steven Crowder, the guy that harassed me, was originally a Fox News contributor and then got fired from Fox News for not being very good at his job and then got hired by The Blaze Media, which is Glenn Beck, who was also fired from Fox News' media enterprise. And then he got his YouTube show. Mm-hmm. So now they have to exist on YouTube, where YouTube is essentially just like linking them up with corporate sponsors of their own and then also getting them tons of money through things like Patreon or side gigs.
But it's lucrative. People like Steven Crowder.
Tremendously lucrative. They are making a lot more money than I imagine I will be making for a very long time.
So you've got this real problem with mainstream media. What can the mainstream learn from what's happening on YouTube, either on the left or on the right?
I have like an optimistic and a pessimistic version of this answer. My pessimistic version is just that mainstream media is doomed to fail on this platform, because the whole idea of mainstream media is that it is defined largely by corporate sponsorships for the most part. If you think about cable news or any of the big establishment legacy medias, they rely on ads. And so their content is almost always going to be less authentic, less real feeling, less accessible to an audience than sort of the more indie-ish creators on the right are. And there is this deeply ingrained idea in traditional media outlets and in mainstream media and in every J school in this country that to be a good journalist means being serious. It means being neutral. I could give you like the whole Chomsky Media Literacy 101 critique of why that idea is dumb and like makes for bad journalism. But in this context, it also makes for YouTube, because when you are a Wolf Blitzer type and you show no emotion about what you're reporting on and have no worldview and are ideologically kind of detached from whatever you're covering, it breeds distrust. It breeds feelings of detachment. People feel like they don't understand you or don't know you. They don't feel particularly compelled to care about what you care about. And so sort of the cost of entry of doing well on YouTube is you have to let go of this idea that you're going to be this like tabula rasa, blank slate, objective journalist and speak like a human. In my intro video, I really went out of my way to say, you know, I am a leftist and like you can expect this from me. And also I want you to know that about me, because if this isn't your cup of tea, you're not going to be persuaded. But if you're curious about it, you might be persuaded. But like, here's my goal. I want you to be a socialist too. I want you to be a Marxist too. I'm going to try my best to like entertain you and persuade you of that idea. And that engenders a kind of trust on the part of the audience.
Carlos Maza, now an independent video producer on YouTube. Thanks so much for joining me, Carlos.
Thanks for having me.
We did reach out to YouTube for comment. As of this airing, they have not responded to that request. This is Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. After Christmas, Valentine's Day is the second most popular holiday for sending cards. An estimated 145 million cards will be exchanged tomorrow, and yet several big card companies and retailers like Papyrus, American Greetings, and Carlton Cards have all recently declared bankruptcy. In their place, though, a group of smaller indie designers and artists have sprung up, just as millennials and Generation Z are looking for ways to connect and express themselves outside of social media. For a look at our relationship with greeting cards and handwritten sentiments today, I'm joined by Carrie Gifford, co-founder and creative director of the company Red Cap Cards, and Tanzila Ahmed, an activist and storyteller who has for years had a line of cards on Etsy she calls Muslim Valentine's Day Cards. Both of you, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
So, Tanzila, you and I go way back, and we've seen you launch this series to great acclaim. Where'd you come up with this idea of Muslim Valentine's Day cards?
So I was a part of a book called Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. And we'd go on book tour and I'd get asked all these really absurd questions about, do Muslim women love? Are we capable of love? And I just thought it was so ridiculous. I started using the hashtag Muslim V-Day and coming up with like really weird political types of card sayings. And after a while, all my friends were like, you should just turn these sayings into actual cards. And now it's turned into this 8-year-long project, which is pretty wild.
And you're the artist as well as the writer?
I am the artist as well as the writer, yeah.
Oh, they're very lovingly done. I guess that's part of the appeal of them is that they're actually attractive cards and not just cheeky.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, we got to make them a little cute, too, you know? We can't just have just sayings.
So let's hear some of the quotes. A couple that stood out to me were... from your cards are, call your representative, then call me. And touchingly, I'd never Muslim ban you from my heart.
Yeah.
So what are some of your own favorites?
I have one inspired from the wall that is getting built. There's no border wall that could keep us apart. Mm-hmm. And then another one with a little chain around it is, I'd never deport you.
And then there's So Fly List. Carrie, if we didn't have Etsy, do you think Taz could have ever gotten her cards sold at a big box store or published through Hallmark?
No.
No chance. Huh?
No, I think, I went through, before I started Red Cap with my husband, when we started, I was the original illustrator. And then over time, I actually did illustrations for some of these other companies. And they put you through a gigantic testing process. And if your images aren't going to speak to this test audience that they put it out with, then the chances are they're not going to make your card. They're not going to make your card.
So they're just big and bureaucratic places.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's just like when you do something like that versus with smaller companies like us, we're not going to test our products. We're going to be making products from our heart, things that make sense to us, things that we believe in, things that we see that are missing in the market. And that's not their goal. Their goal is to, you know, sell as many cards as possible.
I mean, do you think that this, conservatism in terms of their approach is actually contributing to the decline of these big card companies?
I think so. I think that we have, you know, a thoughtful, intelligent, you know, consumers out there who are looking for something that they can connect with. And nowadays, I think people are feeling the need to connect in a way that's more personal to them. And we have a lot of younger buyers. The card market used to be a lot of the baby boomer type of people out there buying and giving cards. And now, you know, we have a new generation of people who want something that is a tangible way to connect. And they're not probably seeing themselves in those markets.
Tanzila, what kind of reaction did you get when you started selling these cards? I mean, I guess you had some friends who were really eating it up, right?
Yeah, I have a lot of friends that were really into the cards, but I got a lot of pushback too. I got a lot of pushback from very conservative non-Muslim communities that were saying that I was spreading jihad through my cards, which is just absolutely ridiculous. And then also from the conservative Muslim community, they're saying that I'm putting out a bad portrayal of what it means to be Muslim.
So Carrie, have you seen like a real evolution in terms of the sentiments themselves over the years, or is it pretty much largely sort of stuck in a very, you know, traditional mode of expression?
I think I have. I think, you know, you have your traditional birthday, thank you, all your holiday categories of greeting cards that people give cards for. But I think what we're seeing now is a lot of people wanting to give cards that are more about uplifting, empowering messages and more personal notes, things that have to do with more about empathy and encouragement and even mental health, or cards that are just more diverse in their artwork and picture. I just think these are cards that traditionally you wouldn't have found in a market. And now we're seeing a lot of people who are far more connected to their own lives and their own emotions and how they're feeling. And I think, you know, and all the, they're in this feeling of support with one another. So you're seeing a lot of people giving cards for these reasons. And I know just with our artists, we have a lot of artists who want to make cards like that. And even as a company, we're always kind of looking for that message as well, something that's making us feel good about who we are as individuals.
And so do you think the bigger companies were just sort of too disconnected from these changes to kind of respond to them?
You know, it's hard to say. I don't know exactly what their thought process is, but I'm pretty sure it has to do with they know that a birthday card is about 80 to 90% of their business. And so they're going to focus on making those, and they're going to focus on a thank you card, and they're going to focus on these, you know, on these very, you know, general occasions, but they're not going to dive deep into, like, you know, a more deeper emotional palette of who we are all as a humanity. Like, you know, they don't want to put their money into, you know, mental health when they know they can sell 80% of their cards or birthday. It's just kind of, I think, where they're at.
That's Carrie Gifford, co-founder and creative director of the company Red Cap Cards, and Tanzila Ahmed, an activist and storyteller who sells her Muslim Valentine's Day cards on Etsy. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We asked if you still send or receive handwritten letters and greeting cards, and we heard from so many of our listeners on this.
Hi, it's Ben from Venice. My mom sends me cards often, and in them are little notes. One of the notes said, "This is your life. Create it, or someone else will." I put these notes up around my apartment, and I always look at them. It's really nice to get handwritten notes from a loved one.
Hi, my name is Erica, and I'm calling from Santa Cruz. And yes, I do still write letters, and sometimes my grandkids do too. My most recent one is from one of my granddaughters, and it says, "I love you, and I love your cookies. Love, Maxine." It's the best kind of letter to get. Email just doesn't do it.
This is Kelly from Oviedo, Florida. I make all my own cards. I'm an artist, and I do special drawings, write personal notes, and decorate the envelopes as well. The envelopes are especially fun. I incorporate the name and address into elaborate pictures. Sending handwritten letters is a lost art, and I take great pleasure in making and sending them. The responses are overwhelmingly positive.
This is Nikki Mohammed Fauzi from Arlington, Texas. I still receive letters and cards from friends and family. My favorite is a message from my friend Bonnie, who said, "I love that our friendship is still so strong, that even having not corresponded with each other for several years, we're able to pick up right where we left off as though the last conversation we had was yesterday."
Hi, this is Reem calling from Ridgewood, New Jersey. In the last 2 weeks, my family had to say goodbye to a beloved pet, and it was completely unexpected and especially hard on me because I had to make a lot of the hard decisions to let him go. Just today, we received a lovely handwritten note from the veterinarians who took care of Sydney in his last days, along with a packet of seeds to plant flowers in his memory. And part of the note reads as follows: "He was a very special soul, and it was easy to see how much he was loved. Please find solace in all of your wonderful memories of him." Seeing this really helped me feel better about some of the hard decisions that I had to make, and it's definitely helped me feel more at ease without having Sydney around.
Thanks for the calls, and a happy early Valentine's Day. But one last thing before we go, a quick shout out to the folks who make this show every week. Our producing team is headed up by senior producer Alexandra Boti and includes Ethan Oberman, Jackie Martin, Jose Olivares, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry are our board ops. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Oh, and if you liked any music you heard on the show this week or you hated it, he is behind all of it. So credit or blame him. Our digital editors are Pauli Irungu and Dina Syed Ahmed. Katrina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our executive assistant and a man who knows how to get things. And special thanks, as always, to acting EP Lee Hill. Thanks so much for listening. Amy Walter is in tomorrow for politics. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway. See you next week.